Welcome. This is William Evans, and you're listening to Shifting Gears. Our guest today is Dan Richardson, Mayor of Carbondale. Welcome, Dan.
Thanks, Will.
Thank you for returning. In our first KDNK conversation, we spoke about how communication obstacles can block solutions to community and even global problems. And those blockages can propel a number of people and resources into a gray area.
Indeed.
Do you have anything more you'd like to say about the gray area? That wasn't very much.
Well, I think by gray area, you're talking about where essentially our economy, our environment, and our social fabric all come together. And the conundrum we're in trying to find balance in those three legs of the stool, if you will.
Yeah, there's a lack of balance, it seems to me, like in the gray area, in that I think it's getting bigger and significant weights accumulating in there that's not reaching its potential.
I would agree. I think we're learning, we've been learning that balance ever since man set foot on Earth. And unfortunately, I think we're realizing that our impacts to, in this case, the social arena and our environment are much greater than we thought. And so we're having to correct as we go.
Yeah, and I think we may be just getting the glimpse of the consequences of the petrochemical experiment.
Oh, absolutely. I think we're realizing, again, that the impacts are greater than we thought. And when I say impacts, I mean negative consequences.
Right, the risk factors.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was useful for me to reflect over this past month about this massive wasteful gray zone and how my experience of being in there has evolved over my life.
I have had similar reflections since our last conversation and how those discoveries essentially have shaped my life. Because once you learn what your impacts are, it's hard to go back.
Well, it is, but you realize, or at least I do, for my children and my grandchildren, I have a responsibility to recognize what works and what doesn't work, what's healthy and what's unhealthy.
Mm-hmm.
And I told you last time that I grew up thinking most of life was a competitive event, and I thought that's what it was like in the gray zone, and that wasn't a lot of fun. That was kind of miserable. I realized that I was looking at the world in that zone from a you or me perspective, and there was an either-or quality that fueled my behavior and narrowed my options and lowered my resilience.
I think it's interesting when you said that, when you talked about competition. I think competition exists in the natural world, and I don't think competition in and of itself is bad. But the question is, are we competing to win, or are we competing to be the best we can be? And I think that shapes the outcome.
Oh, I think it's the probably the key discernment, because we're all in this together. And if I don't realize that, I'm isolated and not in a partnership with the life-sustaining elements and relationships that are key for me and my children and my community.
Mm-hmm. And hopefully those rules that you set, as I mentioned, are we competing to be the best we can be? Hopefully there are some rules that go along with it to say, as long as certain lines aren't crossed, we aren't willing to cheat, we aren't willing to harm others and things of that nature. And if that exists, then I think competition can be healthy.
Well, I think at the root of that for me is my identity. And I understand my identity now to be one of total connection with everyone and everything alive and moving and swirling both in the gray zone and all around Mother Earth.
Yeah, then it's pretty hard to break any rules. Well, I guess you're saying there really aren't any rules. You're just you're all one.
Well, Amory has a good line that way. He says, Mother Earth bats last.
Yeah, that sounds like Amory.
And he was helpful to me, too, in the clarity with which he saw himself and his identity. He told me a story some years ago.
I was getting immersed in energy, and it was also obvious that the whole energy scene was going to blow up in the next few years. So in 71, 2 years before the Arab oil embargo, I asked authorities at Oxford, where I was a don, whether I could do a doctorate in energy. And they said, energy? What's that? It's not an academic subject, is it? We have to chair it and pick a real subject. So I said, well, sorry, I think it's really important. I need to go do it, so I think I'll just resign the fellowship, move on, and go work on energy. So I did.
That's remarkable.
Well, it is, because he grew up with a lot of gifts, but a lot of clarity. And I think there are a number of very successful people who have had that experience and achieved remarkable things for the benefit of a lot of us.
Mm-hmm. I think, just to be clear, I think what's remarkable about that is obviously his colleague at Oxford didn't comprehend how energy would become the lifeblood of this economy. Clearly, Amory did. And I suspect he had a pretty good understanding of what the negative impacts could be from a business-as-usual approach even at that time.
Well, and he said another thing to me that was helpful in relation to the gray zone, because I think part of what can accumulate in the gray zone is change that we are not functionally working with or are in alignment with.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked Amory what resilience meant to him.
Well, it isn't just a static ability to withstand shocks and surprises, but it's an active learning quality that lets you treat change as your friend. And the more things change around you, the more you learn how to benefit from it and become more resilient.
Well said. I thought back to our earlier conversation about listening. And when we're listening well, we're learning, and how important that is to sort of listen to the environment around us and accept the change that perhaps we don't have control of.
And you mentioned the influence that reading Natural Capitalism had on you and the identity and the level of activity you decided to take politically.
Mm-hmm. Amory wrote a book called Natural Capitalism back in the, it was either late 90s, early 2000. And it fundamentally changed the way I viewed our economy and therefore capitalism. And what I realized is that we do have control. The choices we make in pursuing economic prosperity have huge consequences. And one of the concepts that he illuminates in that book is this notion of a service-based economy as opposed to a product-based economy. And his point was, we value people, we value the labor that they produce. Why can't we focus our efforts on incentivizing labor instead of using products which ultimately result in a quicker degradation of the environment? That, as well as many other thoughts, really had me rethink the way I wanted to pursue my career. And there was some stories he told that inspired me to run for public office in Glenwood at that time.
Well, figuring out who I am has helped me enter the gray zone with a whole new attitude. And I would have to acknowledge the good fortune of friends and teachers who helped me along the way, because it resulted in my gaining some awareness and skills. I suspect you may have had some similar experiences.
Many. Many along the way, and I've tried to pay attention to those to shape my life with as much intention as possible.
Well, I think we're fortunate when we're able to do that. This is KDNK. You're listening to a conversation with Dan Richardson, mayor of Carbondale, about what we arrived at in our last conversation, the gray zone of unresolved issues and neglected resources and seeds for healthy growth. One of the other people who really helped me was a man named George Leonard. He was an Aikido master in the Bay Area, and he said to me that he realized health is proportional to the number of perceived options available, and that if an individual or an organization gets trapped in a corner and loses options, they're more likely to behave in a violent or unnecessarily aggressive way that doesn't yield the resolution and the healthy growth that we all need to not only cope, but to heal the condition we're in at this time.
That's interesting. Rings true.
Another person who was helpful was the artist Fred Haberlein. And he would talk to me about we're living in a time where we have a choice to realize it's a you and me world. And Lon Winston has talked to me that that's how he sees his whole theater activity, that it's not an individual star, but it's the collective of everybody who's participating.
Mm-hmm. Fred was my neighbor for a few years. And
oh, wow. I bet that was an experience.
We had some great conversations. And yeah, few people really embraced life and the people around him as much as Fred.
Was that out at No Name?
It was.
All right. The other thing that's been helpful for me is to realize that when I'm not trapped in an either-or worldview, but I'm seeing and, I'm often dealing with a paradox.
Tell me more about that.
Well, an example I use is water. Water is life. And when I say that, I get a feeling. Water flows uphill toward money. Carter Jackson, the retired vet, who's now passed but had a ranch, I went down and talked to him several times, and I asked him, what did they teach you about irrigating? And he immediately said, water flows uphill toward money. And that's the law. That's true, too. So how do I hold that? And one of the definitions I like about maturity is it's the ability to hold a paradox without dropping one or the other. So the degree to which I'm carrying the reality of source water with that clarity, I'm in a different relationship and posture with the law and water flowing uphill toward money or over the hill or through the hill toward Denver.
Mm-hmm.
Then if I'm lacking clarity and relationship and partnership with the source water that's right here.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about that in relation to the environmental impact we spoke of earlier. And it's, I'm thinking that paradox, it's almost where this notion of resilience loses capacity. Perhaps that's not the right way to phrase it, but if you were to pump water uphill into an area that wasn't perhaps intended to have water, if it was a small area, the natural system would absorb that, and you wouldn't offset the balance too much of the ecosystem. But if you do enough of that, if you pump enough water uphill to an area where it's not, where it wasn't necessarily intended to go, and obviously removing water from where it was intended to go, you start to offset that balance. And I think that's perhaps what you and I are talking about, is we have reached a point where not only are we out of balance, but we're now starting to really comprehend how out of balance and what that means to us.
And what it means to our children.
Yeah, us.
Well, a paradox is two apparently opposing perspectives that can both equally be true. And paradox is a big part of reality. So it's helpful for me to go into the gray zone, not seeing everything as a contest, but change as a friend, with the possibility of healing, because that's who I am.
Well, we certainly have to. I don't see an option in not envision a future with healing. That perception that we can heal, that we as a community, we as a society, we as a physical environment can heal, not holding that limits, has the potential to degrade our health just mentally. So we have to hold on to that perception that healing is very possible.
Oh, I think it's essential. It's essential. I told Kay the other day, you know, I marvel at Klaus Obermeier, and he fell and broke his femur not that long ago. And he got it treated. He got into physical therapy, and there was not any evidence of doubt that he was going to heal up fully and vigorously and be back on his skis.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of certainty and conviction and clarity, it puts all the systems, the immune system, the healing potential, into alignment with what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm. Going back to the comment that Amory made years ago about the environment bats last, you know, he made me really rethink the term environmentalist, because is it really the environment that I'm protecting when I try and minimize my impact? Really not, because the environment's going to be just fine. It will adapt to whatever we do, I suspect, to a certain degree. The question is, does it adapt so much that our quality of life either diminishes or looks grossly different than the way we know it right now? And I think that's the question at hand.
Well, I think it is. And I think when we began our conversation last month, I asked you about the weather, and you observed there were extreme events and expected to see more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think we're in a real transition.
Sure.
The other thing that I think is extremely interesting and has a potential in resolving some of these things that slide into the gray zone is restorative justice and restorative processes.
Thinking about that transition, and restorative justice to me is a way of reconciling in a way that finds that balance we talked about earlier.
And I think it's got a lot of potential to heal relationships between people and between elements. And we waste a lot of resources and lives in unnecessary conflict.
Arguably, it has the best track record for resolving issues in a sustainable way.
And for some people, it's been something they've used for many thousands of years.
Mm-hmm. I think it draws on inherent human qualities. And I think that's why we're finding that it's much more effective than when we don't do that.
When you first mentioned your interest to me, you had heard somebody speak at a mayor's meeting from Manitou Springs. And I had a conversation today with the chief of police in Manitou Springs. And he said that it's definitely something they continue to find beneficial and the town actively supports.
Mm-hmm. To me, it represents a much more humanistic way to resolve conflict. And there's no better place to do that than in the court system. And I think it's almost antithetical to the changes we're seeing elsewhere in society with mainly social media, where we're removing that social construct of face-to-face, I would say responsible communication. And so I was quite interested in it and am now in a process of trying to learn more about how we handle that here in the town of Carbondale.
So you think there's some potential we could see more restorative justice process here?
Well, I wouldn't say that yet until I know just how in-depth we're incorporating it now. I've heard some very positive things about how our courts handle certain cases and various organizations that are involved in the process beyond just slapping a fine or jail time to a sentence. So there's always potential for more, but I'm optimistic that we're doing quite a bit already. After our last conversation, I asked myself the question, well, through this dialogue, we're acknowledging that this paradox exists, that we are, as I mentioned earlier, we're struggling to find this balance between our environment and our social fabric and our economy. And I asked myself, so what does that look like on a day-to-day basis? How does one consciously address that balance on a decision-by-decision basis? And it did bring me back to our earlier conversation and this concept of listening and compassion. And while on the surface you could say, well, if we're going to minimize our environmental impact, we should reduce our energy use and use less water and recycle. But that's just nipping at the edges. The more I thought about it, the more I realized that really, as you talked about earlier, seeing ourselves as one, and on the surface, that could just be listening and being compassionate to everyone around us, so that whatever decision we make is a more holistic decision rather than one based on a true nuts and bolts cost-benefit analysis of which one, you know, causes less greenhouse gas emissions or something to that effect. So that's just what came to mind as I tried to bring this down a layer.
For me, it's an in-the-moment process that's going on. And it's, where is my heart mind and what is my intention? And then I can make a decision in a moment about which way I'm going to go or what I'm going to do. It's benefited by the aging process for me, because the wonderful thing about being older is you are comfortable moving more slowly and you have time to reflect on what you're doing and see the consequences and the impact on the fact that we're all in this together. And as I make a change, I model that for my children. And then they raise their grandchildren with that awareness. Mm-hmm. So I think that we have some remarkable examples in North America of very old indigenous cultures that paid a lot of attention to what they did in regard to their children and sometimes reinvented themselves with success, even through the assimilation of what we've done. And they and their relationship with the life around them and within them continues to inspire me.
I think there's a beautiful tie-in to this conversation with restorative justice, as we just talked about, and how that process is intended essentially to bring, like you say, to see that we're all connected. If there is harm done through a crime and you're able to see what the impact of that crime, whether it's to the victim or to the broader community, there's obviously more awareness, more understanding, and as time is proving, a much less likelihood that that crime will occur again from that person.
And a willingness, when people realize what the consequences have been, I think, to take responsibility and make what amends they're able to make and live with a different attitude than if that healing doesn't take place and they're tying up energy and reserves and trying to conceal something.
Mm-hmm. And that's part of the way I see restorative justice, is it engages you in every way.
In my experience with restorative justice and with the teaching I received from my indigenous relatives, is that the outcome and the intention is that the person who is responsible for whatever happened that resulted in the restorative process comes out with their identity intact and their relationships functioning. The purpose is not to shame or humiliate,
right,
but rather to collectively realize what's happened and take responsibility for it. And that's all doable because of the willingness to be in relationship.
I believe we all come in and go out of integrity on a regular basis.
I think that's a memorable generalization.
So I see it as, rather than feeling guilt or shaming the other person, in the case of restorative justice in the courts, the victim is just simply helping us find a faster path back into integrity.
I love that. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Will.
You've been listening to a conversation with Dan Richardson, mayor of Carbondale, and we've been talking about what we're learning in the way of solving problems, and particularly excited about the possibilities of authentic restorative traditions and processes. This is KDNK. Thank you for listening.